Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Road Warrior Radio. You're tuning in live this Thursday, December 12th, 2019 on the one and only Republic Broadcasting Network. And as always, thanks for coming along for the ride. And it's been a wild and dystopic ride for quite a while. Quite some time. In 1947, the National Security Act was passed, which gave us all kinds of fun things. It institutionalized things that never probably should have existed in the first place. Not at all. One of those things is the RAND Corporation. And I want to give you a little window into the past. How long have we been dealing with these issues that we face today? Well, quite a while. In 1967, the RAND Corporation was already 20 years on in studying some very interesting problems and dilemmas that with and by which mankind is faced. And so here's a little excerpt, a few of the folks of the RAND Corporation talking to Walter Cronkite about what the year 2000 would look like. Give this a listen. Go ahead, please.
Your film is now ready to be shown.
Genetic control, 20% probability. 01, yes, here's the unlikely event that became true, and I just go on through the others the same way.
This is not a crap game. It's a serious game at the University of Pittsburgh about the year 2001. Rolling the dice is Dr. Olaf Helmer of the RAND Corporation. With Theodore Gordon, he is conducting a simulation exercise. A panel of experts has studied a list of possible 21st century developments, from personality control drugs to household robots. They have estimated the numerical probability of each, from 0 to 100%. The 20-sided dice are then rolled to simulate these probabilities, a use of random numbers known as the Monte Carlo technique, and often used in think tank games. All of this is highly speculative, but the game serves a useful function. It encourages talented people to think about the future, the current fascination of a new intellectual breed, the futurists.
So we wind up with a world which has the following features. We have fertility control, 100-year lifespan, controlled thermonuclear power, continued automation, genetic control, man-machine symbiosis, household robots, wideband communications, opinion control, and continued urbanization.
A 71-year-old futurist who has been called the citizen of the 21st century, architect engineer R. Buckminster Fuller.
We ourselves consist physically of atoms, and we know that all the atoms have their frequencies. It is theoretically possible to pick up all of our frequencies and actually send us by radio.
You mean we'll be able to transmit ourselves somewhere else?
Yes.
To be reconstituted in some distant place?
Yeah.
Today at our universities and research centers, in government and in business, the futurists are looking at the 21st century. They do not pretend to be prophets. They say the future cannot be predicted. It will be invented, and it is determinable. People can determine the future if they understand and then decide on the choices open to them. The most important choices are likely to be sociological, political, and economic, not technological. In this broadcast, we will look at the future with the futurists, with these men. Sir Peter Brian Medawar is a Nobel Prize-winning zoologist. Dennis Gabor is a physicist at the Imperial College of Science and Technology, London, and author of Inventing the Future. Daniel Bell is chairman of the Sociology Department, Columbia University, and head of the Commission for the Year 2000. Walter Sullivan is science editor of the New York Times. Gerard Peel is editor and publisher of the magazine Scientific American. Lord Ritchie Calder is a science writer and professor of international relations, Edinburgh University. Herman Kahn is director of the Hudson Institute and author of On Thermonuclear War. Isaac Asimov is a science and science fiction writer and professor of biochemistry, Boston University. Harrison Brown is professor of geochemistry, California Institute of Technology, and author of The Challenge of Man's Future. Bertrand de Jouvenel is a French economist and journalist and director of the future-oriented group, The Futurables.
If I were offered to spend a day in the year 2000 and see how things are then, I said, see how things are to be, I would hate it. Because I don't know, I don't want to know how things are to be. I want to exert action as long as I live so that the sort of things which should, in my opinion, be, have more chances of being. If they're all set, it doesn't interest me any more to see the year 2000 than it interests me to see the year 1000. The merit of the future is that it is not set. The merit of the future is that it is the area in which we can exert our will, exert our efforts, and try to validate our values. That is the merit of the future.
Some people talk about predicting the future as if the future was going to unfold itself independently of our own wishes and desires. Now, I think one can take it as one of the great lessons of modern science or modern technology that anything that is in principle possible will be done if people want to do it enough. So when one asks what is going to happen in the 21st century, what one really wants to ask is, what do we want to happen in the 21st century?
I'm myself a physical inventor, a passionate inventor, and I'm very well aware that I'm one of the probably last generation of physical inventors. Of course, we still need inventions, but we don't need very much in terms of physics. Biological inventions we still need. Cancer is still something we must get rid of. But after that, what is important, the creative minority must put their mind on human happiness, on the study of psychology and of sociology. If it were up to me, I wouldn't let a single first-class talent go any more into physics or chemistry.
Where would you put them?
Into psychology.
If I can be perhaps overly large about it, I would say we're becoming an intellectual society. Not that everybody's going to be an intellectual. This is a business civilization today. Most people are not businessmen, but the basic values that society have been in terms of business, the basic rewards go to business. And I think in the same way, the basic institutions of the new society would be intellectual institutions, in that the scientists, engineers, mathematicians, economists will be the new men of the society. And I think it's true for one very important reason. It's not that we have more knowledge, which we do. There's a change in the character of the knowledge. This, I think, is the most important thing. And it's a change in the character of the knowledge in this respect that, by and large, the most important knowledge today is theoretical knowledge. This is where it seems to me the intellectual institutions, and particularly the university, becomes important.
Mr. Bell, most of us are inclined to think pretty much the 21st century in terms of the gadgets we're going to have, the push-button life we're going to lead. Is that the way we ought to be looking at the next century?
Well, it's a very entrancing way of doing it, surely. But I'm not sure it really helps very much. I think so much of the discussions I've read about the future get concentrated on the new kinds of things that men will be able to do. It sort of feeds the kind of Batman or Superman kind of instincts some of us have, you know, in terms of the being omnipotent in this particular way. Now, 35 years ago, one of the things which entranced people completely was the idea of fractional horsepower. And if you read the technological journals, the idea was everybody's lives can be transformed with fractional horsepower, small motors. Now, it's true to some extent they help, because with fractional horsepower, you begin to get electric carving knives, you begin to get electric toothbrushes, but I won't say that these have necessarily transformed our lives in a very meaningful way. So I'm not sure that gadgetry is the best way of looking at the future. I would say, perhaps this reflects my own bent as a sociologist, to try to look at structural changes in society, which is why I come back to things like changes in the pattern of occupation, changes in the sector distribution of an economy, changes in the character of knowledge, as overall determinative of the kinds of jobs and lives people will have.
What do you think will be the major scientific breakthroughs in the next 34 years before the turn of the century?
Well, of course, there may be some fundamental breakthroughs in knowledge, knowledge of the nature of the universe, you know, resolving these problems as to the nature of the universe, whether it's an eternal, ever-expanding universe or an oscillating, expanding and contracting kind of a universe, things of tremendous philosophical interest, but perhaps of more remote practical importance. Another one of these would relate to the nature of matter. Here we've been groping towards an understanding of the nature of matter, and it looked very simple a generation ago. Now it's gotten terribly complicated with all of the many different little bits of matter that you can produce in an atom smasher. But obviously, behind all of this, there's some system, there's some pattern, and perhaps we'll get this. Again, the practical applications of this are hard to foresee. But there are also very practical things that I hope and think that we are going to do. We're going to make it practical to produce energy in a clean way and in great quantity, perhaps through harnessing the hydrogen bomb reaction, the fusion reaction. These recent developments in producing batteries and fuel cells that can be used to store and make use of energy conjures up such a wonderful world, you know, of no automobile exhaust, no stack gases, you know. This really could be a brave new world of clean cities and clean highways. And this, it seems to me, is within reach.
By far the most important task of modern medicine is to extend throughout the whole world the kind of medical advantages and privileges which are enjoyed today in the United States and in the advanced Western countries generally. And this will have to happen. This isn't merely a medical problem. This is a tremendous problem of administration, a problem of politics as well. And needless to say, it would be pointless to achieve it unless it were accompanied by a population policy. Because one of the consequences of these advances in medicine, indeed, it's already happening, is the threat, which is now a reality, of overpopulation.
I have a phrase which I use in my lectures to my students, which is, freedom begins with breakfast. And you can have all the freedom in the world, but if you're not fed and you're not taken care of, if society is not taking care of your needs, then you're not free. The liberated slave dies in the ditch, you know, of hunger. And therefore, we've got to come to terms with what, in fact, are the basic requirements of this vast population we're going to have. And on that world scale of population, not just pockets of hunger, but really beginning to look at this problem as a potential catastrophe of mankind. The population explosion is just, to me, as serious as the atomic explosion.
The number one human problem I would name is the problem with which two-thirds of mankind goes to bed every night, and that's the problem, when do we eat? The feeding of mankind, the feeding of the poor, the clothing of them, the housing of them, means the industrial revolution of the underdeveloped countries of the world. So how is that revolution going to be managed humanely? The industrial revolutions that have occurred so far in history have been pretty cruel operations. We deplore the Russian story, we look with horror on the Chinese story, but we ought to examine our own histories and our own memories of what it took to conduct the American Industrial Revolution. The 35 million human beings that arrived in steerage passage and percolated through the slums of our cities, the Chinese that are buried under the ties of the railroads, Archibald MacLeish has said, the reconstruction of the human cost of our industrial revolution would appall us if we did it honestly. The answer to this problem is economic aid, and economic aid highly informed by science and technology. The important thing here is information transfer. It's transfer of technology. Technology form of the education of the cadres of engineers and scientists that are needed, and doctors and physicians and technicians of all kinds. The delivery of a dollar worth of this aid stimulates the production of a total of at least $5 of local activity in economic development, potentially in Brazil or India, because the major input at the other end is labor, and mineral or agricultural resources, which they have in abundance. And this is the best bet the American people could lay on the future with the enormous resources and capacity that the scientific industrial revolution has placed at the disposal of our democracy.
Well, we keep on saying that the great conflict which is coming, I don't necessarily mean a war conflict, but a conflict of attitude, is not no longer East-West, it's North-South. It is, in fact, the colored world against the what I call North Temperate Zone man. It's a rather useful description, then, by the way. It includes the whole of North America, includes the whole of Europe, includes the whole of Russia and Japan. It's really the clash between the highly developed countries and the underdeveloped countries.
They talk about undeveloped countries and how people are going to get the most advanced technology. This is how it's going to happen. It's going to happen via the moon. For the first time in the history of man, they're sending man off into space to finally stay there on more than a sandwich and thermos bottle basis, which it's been using so far, to really stay out on the moon for a year, space for a year. You're going to have to send with him everything that he's needed for his ecological regeneration. The air must be there, he has a process, and then he'll have to operate as a process. In doing so, we're going to then have to contract something like a mile diameter activity of the Earth down to a little black box weighing about 500 pounds, the most we can allow, which is going to take care of all his regeneration so that his liquids and everything become satisfactorily regenerative locally. You'll have to add a little to it every once in a while because entropy is at work and systems always really do run down. But he'll be able to operate for a long, long time, and the capsule that he's in will be the first scientific house in the history of man. So with 2 billion people looking at him all the time, the little black box operating there, everybody in the world is going to realize if you could have one of those little black boxes, you don't need any sewer systems, and you don't need any water supplies, you don't need any separate generators in the city. This little black box will just keep you going.
We will continue with Buckminster Fuller on the 21st century in a moment.
Are we in the future likely to have a great increase in the scientific knowledge to a magnitude we can't even dream of today, thanks to men from brawn work to do simply brain work?
I see humans around the world having one very, very important function. You cannot have mass production unless you have mass consumption. The more consumers, the bigger your undertaking. As we really come to automation, which can really do the physical work, people don't have any significance whatsoever anymore as muscle or automatons. Muscle machines. They have only significance as consumers. Whoever has the most customers is going to win in the great industrial battles. This is very important. China, we lost the enormous numbers of customers when we lost China as friend. Whoever is going to get India and Africa and South America to be the patrons of their industrialization needs them for as consumers, not as producers. They don't have to pay for anything. They pay by just being there as regenerative consumers. Because now I'll have to talk about something which will be one of the very big new realizations by 2000 AD, which will be a realistic scientific accounting system of what is wealth. We now know that wealth isn't the goal that the old pirates used to have. Wealth is energy, and we have an Einsteinian world in which the scientists found that when energy left any local system, engine, it only did so by joining another system. It did not go out of the universe. But experiment after experiment, they found the energy never got lost. So they had to write an entirely new law of energy called the Law of Conservation of Energy, which said energy can neither be created nor lost. So suddenly we got a new clue to wealth. Wealth is not something that's going to deteriorate and get lost, which was a great way of thinking in all the economics. Next thing I discovered, that wealth consists of something more than energy. It consists. So I find that nominally that every time we use it, we say, I make an experiment. Now, every time you make an experiment, you always learn more. You can't learn less. You may learn that what you thought was happening isn't happening. That saves you a lot of your time, because we want to then increase the effectiveness of our time. So I then say that the intellectual factor in wealth is one which every time we use it always improves. We always learn more. I've discovered that the energy part can't run down, and the intellectual factor, every time we use it, improves. Therefore, wealth, I discovered, is something that always increases. So that I would then point out to you that
we are going to be able to afford to make everybody customers, and we're going to be able to afford them to bring in your Africa. And this is the answer to your question. We talk, all the world, going to have to make all of humanity successful or none.
What do you think the relative power will be between the present major contenders, China, Soviet Union, the United States, and some of the older powers, England, France?
Well, we would, if we had to guess a kind of a lineup, it'd be something like the following. Two more or less superpowers, United States and Soviet Union, but nowhere near as super as they have been in the past by quite a bit. Five, say, large powers, led by Japan, which is the great undiscussed quantity in the world today. It's a fantastically vital, dynamic country. Probably followed by either West Germany or France. Then, in turn, followed by China. And then there's a United Kingdom probably bringing up the rear. There'd be three intermediate powers, at least. Italy, India, Canada. These are all on the verge of becoming large powers, but not really. And then lots of other powers, of course.
You put Red China fairly far down that list.
Yes.
34 years won't have seen them rise to the Soviet-American rank.
Oh, almost without question not. On the record, China has been the greatest power in the world for about 2,000-3,000 years. Most Americans don't realize this, but during most of the last 2,000-3,000 years, the Chinese were richer than the Europeans per capita in total, more advanced, and so on. When China has been well governed, it's been centrally governed. You know, and they're used to these interregnums of 200-300 years, and then return to power. The problem they have is there's a country lying off their coast, Japan, which is even more impressive. If you took Japan away, I think China would end up as the third largest power. They're competing with Japan, and that, as we learned 20 years ago, is quite difficult. Japan is a country which is currently doubling its gross national product every 7 or 8 years. Nothing has grown that rapidly in the history of the world. Furthermore, if you study the Japanese national character, Japanese mores, Japanese government, Japanese technologies, you know, Japanese decision-making, you more or less conclude there's a good chance this process will continue to the end of the century.
We are now in a world in which no place on Earth is more than a few hours from any other place, where no one on Earth really need be ignorant of what is happening anywhere else on Earth, so that we have the physical, capacity to be a truly single world. What is needed now is merely. What is needed now is getting rid of our habits of thought that date back to the time when every little valley on Earth was far removed from every neighboring valley, when every little city was a separate little world. And this is difficult to do. It may represent, in fact, the greatest problem facing humanity a century from now, when we have all the capacity to conduct our affairs as a reasonable unit. This is not to mean that we're all going to be the same, we're all going to conform, nobody can have regional differences, not at all. We face a number of common dangers. We can defeat those dangers only by common action, and we must learn how to take that common action. We have the physical capacity to do so. We need the heart to do so. How one can tame the human heart is beyond me, except that I think that we have two alternatives. By a century from now, the human heart will be tamed to the extent of facing the problems of the world sufficiently together so as not to kick each other while doing so, or else we will have destroyed ourselves sufficiently so that this entire discussion here means nothing.
I am just as convinced as can be that man today has much more power than he realizes. I am convinced that man has it within his power today to create a world in which people the world over can lead free and abundant and even creative lives, and that starting now, applying the power we have is none too soon. We have already waited to the point where we are in very serious danger of painting ourselves into a corner. One of our problems is that we tend to live for today. We tend to say that, well, in one way or another, things will work themselves out. We can no longer afford to behave that way. We must take a long-range view of man and his problems, And we must attempt to the best of our ability to look into the future, to ask where we are heading. And if we don't like where we're heading, then to start now to do something about it. It's purely a question of putting that power to work, putting it to work energetically enough. And here is where my fears really lie. I fear that we won't recognize soon enough that we do have this power, and once recognizing it, that we will put it to work rapidly enough. But I am convinced that this can happen. I am convinced that we can create a world which will pale the golden age of Pericles into nothingness.
And there you have it. Good times, huh? Good times. A bunch of technocrats sitting around at the Rand Corporation talking to Walter Cronkite about what the year 2000, what the 21st century would look like. And is it me, or is it disturbing, to say the least, how casually these people sit around and talk about things like Peter Brian Medawar, the threat and reality of overpopulation. You know, we have an administration problem. This guy is, might as well just be saying, I'm a hardcore technocrat. Now that, go to the Oracle Illusion Technocracy Movement entry, Technocrats Plan. Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods. Isn't that what we heard? You know, what was the other little excerpt? It was Buckminster Fuller. You know, who's going to win is whoever has the most automatons as customers. Unbelievable. That's just horrifying. So, Peter Brian Medawar, the administrative problem or the administration problem, which is just, you know, for technocrats, it's the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population. Technocracy will distribute by means of a certificate of distribution available to every citizen from birth to death. Who decides? That's always the question. Always the question. Who decides? Who's deciding for other people? So, if these guys sitting around, you know, who was it that was saying, you know, is the last generation of physical inventors, the creative minority? He would put people into the study of psychology and sociology. If you had to put people into anything, not physics, not this, not that, I would put them into psychology. These people are, I mean, honestly, the first thought that comes to my mind is social deviants. And I think it's interesting, you listen to something like this and you look back over the last 50 years, and there just has been enormous effort and resources put into controlling and manipulation, control and manipulation of one's fellow man. You know, I mean, listen to the hubris of these guys sitting around. Batmanic or Superman kind of instincts, omnipotent. Who talks like this? And they listen to them. They're not talking like, they're talking about their own house or their own city or neighbor. They're talking about the entire world. You know, a brave new world of clean cities, but, you know, we have these problems. We could, you know, the 21st century could be a brave new world of these clean cities. That's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, the administration problem accompanied by a population policy. Because, you know, the threat and reality of overpopulation, the Malthusians argue, it's here. Ah, except it's not. World population is in decline. World Bank numbers. Where is that? I always look at that little funny little Population growth, annual population growth data. Ever since these guys were sitting around talking, that number's been in sharp decline. Ever since the infamous NSSM 200, Henry Kissinger. I mean, it's sharp decline, and it's down to the world population growth figures are 1.109. And what's interesting about that is that you need about double that to sustain a population, not even to grow. So it's not population growth, it's population decline. Contrary to what we're hearing, contrary to the shuffling of people around, what Kelly Greenhill would refer to as coercive engineered migration. Think about it. Go to the little towns across the country. I mentioned the story yesterday that Ripple, I think it was yesterday, about the five areas that job growth and so on have concentrated in. Was that yesterday or the day before? I think it was yesterday, wasn't it? I guess it was the day before. Yes, it was. Was it? Yep. So anyway, the Brookings study in particular, 90% of high-tech job growth has happened in five metro areas. That one. And outside of that, what is happening? And most of us can't see. You can't see, you know, if your town's larger than a few thousand people, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people, you get larger than that. It's difficult to really see with your own eyes unless the growth is significant. There is shuffling around, but what's happening, people don't realize, is that there is a, you know, folks are gathering, clustering in certain areas, and they're headed toward these five metro areas that the Brookings study talked about. The case for growth centers, how to spread tech innovation across America, how to. Brookings is a, you know, the Institute for Government Research. Is, you know, it dates back further than the Rand Corporation, obviously, with the same sorts of nefarious intentions. Manipulation and control of one's fellow man. I just think it's astonishing to see how matter of fact certain people can be. And one of the craziest sound bites Lord Richie Calder, I think it was, yeah, the clash of the big problem that we have to deal with in the 21st century is the clash of the colored world against the developed world. Oh my gosh. And I mean, it's just astonishing, right from the outset, you know, opinion control. This is what, so here, and you can always tell. You can always tell. I mean, these people take themselves way too seriously. It starts out with Walter Cronkite and his authoritative voice, the man that we can all trust, saying, you know, this is not a crap game. It's a serious game. That's what they always say. They got to start out, you know, this is not a joke. It's serious. And these men are scientists. Scientists of studying the, you know, trying to attach something that's obviously not there, even by their own admission, because if it were, they wouldn't have to say that. It's not climate science, it's climate propaganda, for Pete's sake. Go read up on the Club of Rome. Same discussion, you know, and it's just interesting. It's almost as if George Bernard Shaw himself were talking in a few of these, the things that these men are saying. Wealth is energy. That's, again, technocracy. Buckminster Fuller. Now we can afford to bring Africa in. We can't afford to bring Africa in. Yay. Well, what about what those folks want? What about, you know, again, who decides? So you got a bunch of intellectuals sitting around in little walnut paneled offices in Santa Monica talking about what should be happening in Africa. You know? Rolling the dice. Olaf Helmer, Theodore Gordon, conducting a simulation exercise. And what are they looking at? You look at some of the questions that they're considering, and right there on the wall in 1967. And those are the, you know, that's the pedestrian version. That's the version that they don't mind you seeing. Their simulation exercise. Panel of experts. And weather control, a military weapon, is on the wall, by the way. Among other fun things. Social consequences, decline in supernatural beliefs. Oh, you mean like religion? You mean like Christianity in particular? Teaching by direct recording on the brain. I think we're confused. I think we need to define terms. Would you call that teaching? That's you know, this is the time that Ray Kurzweil was building laptops in suitcases. They really were laptops in a suitcase. Teaching by direct recording on the brain. Control of people through symbiosis. Symbiosis. Really? I mean, that's just, again, terms of art, sophistry, a relationship of mutual benefit, perhaps. But, you know, again, the mutual benefit is kind of couched in Dewey-Oxberger sort of terms. Mutually beneficial is a relative term. Depends on who defined terms. If George Bernard Shaw defines terms, and he says things like, you would have to be, you know, you know, as John Stormer quoted Shaw in None Dare Call It Treason, Shaw writing in The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, I also made it clear that socialism means equality of income or nothing, and that under socialism you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly fed, clothed, lodged, taught, and employed, whether you liked it or not. If it were discovered that you had not the character or industry enough to be worth all this trouble, you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner. But whilst you were permitted to live, you would have to live well. These are the kinds of psychopaths that we're dealing with. And unfortunately, this has been, America has been the sort of epicenter, the proxy epicenter of this kind of nonsense for generations, obviously. People sitting around with too much time talking about messing with other people. Tactical behavior control devices. You know, and they start out opinion control, I mean, these are the problems of the future? It's just, it's astonishing to me. And, you know, the seemingly infinite amount of resources that have been put to this. Imagine what would happen if you put these resources to other work. I think I just saw an article yesterday about, well, there was in the Afghanistan series of articles, for example, what if we the Washington Post, oh my goodness, they told us Afghanistan was a fraud. It was, you know, put up job. It was like Vietnam. We were doomed to fail from the outset. Who didn't know that? Zbigniew Brzezinski told us that back in 98, I guess. But even before, the Afghan trap. That's anyone who studies history, anyone who goes to the war colleges or, you know, studies history and military history knows the Afghan trap is where great military leaders go to die on their sword, as I usually say. And so, you know, you got to figure out if you can break that area, you can break anything. And so, yeah, it's been the Afghan trap for all of recorded history. And that's why it's been the area, kind of a focal point over the last couple or few hundred years. If we can do it here, we can do it anywhere. That's why we have to have NATO. We have to have a coalition of the willing or billing, as Jeremy Scahill might say. And then, once you have the coalition, you know, you could sort of swap out, you can tag team it. RL33627. It means more than most people realize. NATO and Afghanistan. A test of the Transatlantic Alliance. A test. And so, you know, we needed a new NATO to go beyond the European theater. How far beyond? Well, you know, just Afghanistan, at least for now. It's an extension of this discussion in 1967, which itself was not new. It wasn't new in 1947, but now it's been institutionalized. You got a bunch of people sitting around. Where do the resources come from for this kind of stuff? The Rand Corporation, originally the army, the military's premier and preeminent think tank. And now, you know, if you have a few million bucks laying around, you want something studied, some kind of problem. I would love to study the threat of people like this and what the opportunity cost is, so to speak, of this kind of manpower and financial resources being dedicated to this kind of nonsense. What is the opportunity cost? Anyway, it's horrifying, I think. Absolutely horrifying. And so we fast forward to today, and many of these grand dreams have come true because they have worked tirelessly to make them happen. And that's the hubris. You know, the kinder, gentler version, the way that Isaac Asimov is putting it, is still manipulation and control of one's fellow man. Since when does anyone have the right to do that, particularly in mass? We have the physical capacity to be a single world. What if we don't want to be a single world? What is needed now is getting rid of our habits of thought that date back to the time when every little valley on earth was far removed from every neighboring valley. Why do we need to get away from that exactly? When every little city was a separate little world. I mean, you start thinking about that. Are we all going to wear the drab smocks, the Hillary Clinton, you know, communist Chinese smock? No offense, Chinese, communist Chinese. I mean, Is that what it comes down to? Who decides? And this is difficult to do. It may represent, in fact, the greatest problem facing humanity a century from now. That's the greatest problem facing humanity? To turn us all into a drab, you know, post-deconstructionist communitarian mob of mindless automatons? Sounds great. Sign me up. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Many people tell us about their experience with Extendivite. Just listen to what Glenn has to say.
Prior to taking it, I had diabetic neuropathy. The Extendivite reduced that significantly. Acid reflux was reduced. I had athlete's foot, very severe. Trimmed that down to about 75% dandruff. Almost completely gone. I had occipital neuralgia at the base of my skull. I was having migraines, reduced by about 90%. Heart palpitations, my heart would kind of stall out. I would skip a beat. Very uncomfortable. And when walking from downstairs going to sleep, by the time I got to the bedroom, which is just one flight of stairs, my heart was pounding coming out of my chest. My vision was blurry. This completely solved that problem. Great product. Thanks.
Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
When you were here before, you couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You flow like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so very special, but I'm a creep. I'm a weirdo. What the hell am I doing here?
Welcome back. Long form content eats up a lot of time, doesn't it? It's interesting. Even the freakish Frankfurt School adherents where did I see that? I don't remember where I saw that. Even they recognized that the media is has been patently fascist. Where did I see that? I don't remember. Anyway, but even they observed media is patently fascist. And the point is, these folks deciding for others, and it's the argument breaks down very quickly. You know, that it's somehow, you know, this humanitarian philanthropic effort. Oh, we're just studying. We just want to help mankind because, you know. No, you don't. Dishonest. What do I mean? Well, in simple terms, the engineering of consent, the manipulation of one's fellow man. I mean, how would these people like it? Would they appreciate it? Would they enjoy it? Or someone to try to con them, and you know, it's ironic because they have been conned, they have been bamboozled. They're usually the most susceptible, and that's, you know, this class that fancies themselves erudite, you know, intellectual, just really kind of pompous, arrogant. Fancies themselves the deciders for us all. The philosopher kings. Argument breaks down quickly. The engineering of consent, it's manipulation, and therefore it's not philanthropic, it's not humanitarian, it's not benevolent, it's very malevolent in nature. And so, you know, you have guys in that camp like Edward Bernays, who says, you know, even in a society of perfectionist educational standard, equal progress would not be achieved in every field. And so what? Well, I guess we'll talk about that in the second hour coming up here after this short break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
When your doctor tells you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.